morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have 6 cases on the calendar today. 4 are oral. We'll be doing the first 3 here and then taking a break for an ITV oral argument at 1:30. The first case on the calendar is State of Minnesota versus Torrance Lee Royster. This case involves consolidated appeals cases A18-1957 and A18-1999. We'll each have 15 minutes for your argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can adjust the podium as need be, and at the beginning of your argument, if you could please introduce yourself for the record, I'd appreciate it. You can proceed when you're ready. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Roy Spurbeck. I'm an attorney with the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Royster. I will probably refer to Mr. Royster as appellant. I know he's appellant respondent, but just for sake of clarity, I'll probably call him appellant. After a court trial in Hennepin County, Mr. Royster was convicted of failure to register as a predatory offender. The court sentenced him to a gross misdemeanor sentence, a downward durational departure from the presumptive prison sentence. Mr. Royster appealed from the judgment to challenge his conviction. The state has appealed the trial court's sentencing decision. The state requested oral argument in this case, and as such, I'm going to focus on the sentencing issue. Judge Cook's sentence was a downward durational departure. As such, the focus is on the offense, not necessarily the offender. Here, Judge Cook stated that he thought that the crime was less serious than typical, gave his reasons why he thought so, and stated that they were substantial and compelling. As a trial judge, Judge Cook did absolutely everything that the law requires he do when announcing the sentence. The state has appealed the sentence, but really, the state simply disagrees with Judge Cook's assessment of the facts and his ruling.
Isn't there also a question as to whether this was a dispositional departure in addition to a durational departure?
That is the state's third sub-sentencing argument. I strongly disagree with that argument. The sentence from a felony sentence to a gross misdemeanor under Minnesota law, both in the case law and the sentencing guidelines, clearly states that it is a durational departure, period. We look at the offense. Was the offense atypical? The state can cite no case, no statute, no section of the guidelines that would call this also require a finding under the dispositional case law.
But wasn't it a mandatory commit as a felony, 24-month presumptive commit?
The sentence is a 24-month, it converts to the guideline sentence, becomes 24 months. The court can still stay the sentence.
But if the court stays the decision, the sentence, wouldn't that be in, when it's a mandatory commit, wouldn't that be a dispositional
if you
departure?
If you announced a felony term, so let's say that Judge Cooks had said, I'm going to commit you to the Commissioner of Corrections for 24 months, but I'm going to stay execution and put you on probation. That's a dispositional departure, clearly. But the first decision that the judge makes in this case, that Judge Cook makes, is he says, I'm sentencing you to a gross misdemeanor. That's a durational departure. Once the sentence is a gross misdemeanor, the guidelines no longer apply. Once the guidelines no longer apply, he doesn't have to make a finding of disposition.
So because he said, I'm sentencing you to 365 days, that was a sentence.
That's a gross misdemeanor.
And so then we look at if there's grounds to support or if he articulated sufficient grounds to support that durational departure.
Yeah, offense related. That's the end of that inquiry. You know, we're 37 years into the sentencing guidelines, and this has never been an argument I've seen advanced by the state. It would actually be a significant change in the policy of the guidelines and of sentencing law, and I don't think this court necessarily wades into policy changes, and that's what this is. So You have a judge, a very experienced trial judge in Hennepin County, who I think has clearly seen a lot of criminal cases. Prior to being a judge, he was a United States attorney, or an assistant United States attorney. He is the trial judge in this case. This is a court trial. He has assessed the facts. He has seen the defendant. He has interacted with the defendant. Based on his review of the record and what he hears, he has determined that this offense is less serious, significantly less serious than typical. He then tells us why. This is what trial judges are supposed to do when they do durational departures. He has done everything he is supposed to do. He is aware that it is a felony sentence. He is aware that it's a 24-month sentence. He knows these things. We know he knows these things because, one, he tells us, and, two, he files a departure report.
So essentially your argument is if there's support for a durational departure and it reduces the sentence from a felony sentence to a gross misdemeanor sentence, it's the end of the inquiry.
It's the, well, I mean, I you're mean, always going to review it for an abuse of discretion, of course.
But I mean,
there's no abuse
but,
here.
But it's the, I mean, and you don't need to even get into dispositional.
That is our position, that there is no dispositional departure. I would also add that,
going back to that point, the sentencing guidelines do provide that when the guidelines recommend a prison sentence, but the court stays the sentence, that's a dispositional departure. And so can you explain to me why the sentence pronounced here wasn't a dispositional departure when the presumptive sentence under the guidelines would be a commit to prison?
Well, I think, again, we have to go back to the first decision the judge makes, is he takes the felony case and makes it a gross misdemeanor. Once it's a gross misdemeanor, the guidelines don't apply.
So your point is we wouldn't, if we accept your argument, we wouldn't look at the guidelines as to what is a dispositional departure because the judge in deciding to do the durational departure took the sentence out of the guidelines.
Absolutely. That is correct. I would also add that, assume I'm wrong, which, you know, people do assume that sometimes. Assume I'm wrong and that there's a dispositional, that this does involve a dispositional departure. Two points I want to make there is I find it odd that the stayed gross misdemeanor sentence would require a dispositional departure when the judge could simply execute any sentence between 91 and 365 days. Putting Mr. Royster on probation is actually a more onerous sanction. And then if he could do less, just simply say 91 days executed, go serve 91 days, without a dispositional departure, I find it odd that the greater sanction requires more than the lesser sanction. Seems odd to me. Seems backwards. But again, assume I'm incorrect and this requires a dispositional departure. The judge gives reasons for a dispositional departure on the record, I think mostly in response to the state's argument that they're required. But even wheeling back from that, the guidelines allow the offense, those factors, to also support dispositional departures. So the same facts that support the downward durational departure to the gross misdemeanor also support a dispositional departure.
So let's assume we agree with you that there's support for the durational departure based on the facts showing that this offense is less onerous. Can that also support the dispositional departure if there was a dispositional departure? Can that same reason support both, or do there need to be two separate reasons?
There does not need to be two separate reasons.
What about don't the guidelines require two separate reasons?
I don't believe so.
I think the guidelines provide that.
Is it the idea that it's two departures?
2D1A provides that a court departing from the presumptive disposition as well as the presumptive duration has made two separate departure decisions, each requiring written departure reasons.
Instead of looking that up as I see it here, I probably will look it up where
I'll. Well, I suppose wouldn't it depend on whether, there can be a durational departure that does not result in a gross misdemeanor, correct?
Absolutely.
And then if there's a dispositional departure, then you do have to consider it, right?
Absolutely.
So the key fact that you're relying on is once that sentence was pronounced as a gross misdemeanor, at that point the guidelines don't apply.
Yeah, well, I'm relying on that. I'm also relying on the fact that we've had the sentencing guidelines for a long time, and I've never seen this. I've never seen this argument. I've never seen a court address it. I do wonder.
Has it been addressed in any case that you can point us to, or can you point us to authority?
I actually cannot point to any authority that it's required. I think if you look at the sentencing transcript, you can tell that Judge Cook is also surprised by the state's argument. I mean, he says something along the lines of, well, I don't think I have to do that, but if I do, and then he gives reasons.
Reason he gave was for the dispositional, he says if he had to find one, the reason would be a lack of substantial capacity for judgment not related to alcohol or drug use. What support in the record is there for that reason?
That is the judge's interaction with Mr. Royster both at the trial and at various hearings. And what he's specifically relying on is the evaluation of Mr. Royster's interaction with the Minneapolis police while he goes down to ask for a registration form, and his sort of conspiratorial feeling that Mr. Royster has while interacting with the police.
Does that show any lack of mental capacity?
Lack substantial capacity for judgment? Yes. I also think you have other times he's interacting with Mr. Royster, including kind of long periods where Mr. Royster is just talking to the court, where I think the judge, who is sitting there evaluating him, is probably in the best position to say, boy, I have some concerns. And I think that's what he's saying there. But again, I don't think it's required. I think if it is required, I think that's valid. I also think the fact of the offense is less serious than the typical offense would support it. I will look at this guideline section. I do wonder if that involves upward departures instead of downward, because I know for an upward departure, you do need separate reasons to move from disposition and duration. I'm not sure if it goes the other way.
Okay, thank you. That'd be helpful.
Sure. I mean, I'll look quick. If there's no other questions, we'd rely on the briefing for both issues and the argument today. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I do have one question for you. Just a test here. No, I'm just kidding. But on the sufficiency of the evidence argument, which you raised in your primary brief, can you explain to me why the evidence that the state cites isn't direct evidence?
Sure. I think as I looked at their sort of list of evidence, I'm still looking at that. I think everything in there still requires an inference related to the knowledge. It is very rare that you're going to have direct evidence on a defendant's mental state. And that really would be almost a statement of, I intended this, I knew this.
But if he's showing up at the police station saying, I know I have to register, why isn't that direct
Well,
evidence?
I don't know that he ever...
I mean, are you saying I need to register and where's the forms? I mean, isn't that direct
I don't know
evidence?
I don't know that it's as direct as I know I need to register.
Well, but I mean, but
well, that's what I mean.
But the reasonable inference and his own statements.
I would say
evidence.
I would acknowledge that there is some strong circumstantial evidence that goes to knowledge in this case. Especially once we reach a point into October. Before that, I think it's much less clear. But once we get into when you look at the steps Mr. Royster's taking to try to figure out what he's supposed to do, I think there you have a stronger circumstantial inference of knowledge. I will agree to that.
I mean, isn't there, though, and this has kind of struck me as I was reading the briefs, isn't there kind of an inconsistency here, though? But at the same time, you're saying, there's not enough evidence here versus the very things he did, In other words, his statements, his going to the police station, his talking to his own attorney, all of that was the basis for the downward durational departure.
I don't think there's any inconsistency at all. Absolutely not. I think it's just a kind of classic alternative argument that we make, which is, boy, I didn't think the state proved it, but the evidence they relied on to prove it shows it's less serious. That is absolutely Judge Cook's opinion as the trier of fact also. He says it many times. He says, I'm going to find you guilty, but. And that's really, my argument really does not differ much from the one that the trial attorney makes in closing about, boy, this is why we don't think they proved it. And then the sentencing argument really mirrors Judge Cook. I don't think it's inconsistent.
I mean, but at the same time, you're saying he knew all of this, that he knew all of this. You're basically using that same evidence as a basis for the durational
departure. I'm saying he made efforts to figure out what he was supposed to do. I still think there's an inference that you have to draw from that he knew that he had to register.
Right.
I think those are slightly different things. I don't think they're also inconsistent. I have no idea, the clock changed. I have no idea where I am on time. I am going to be done.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, my name is Sean Cahill. I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota through the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. At this time, I am asking that the court affirm the finding of guilt and reverse remand for sentencing consistent with the mandatory minimum sentence of 24 months committed to the Department of Corrections. I'm going to lead right off into, I think, our discussion on what happens when we cross that threshold on a durational departure and whether or not that differs from a dispositional departure. I would posit that the mere fact that there's a durational departure down to a gross misdemeanor sentence does not somehow become this threshold or this magic limit where all of a sudden the guidelines don't apply. I would actually note the reverse, that we are to take and look where we are coming from as opposed to where we end up. In other words, that we should be looking at where the presumptive sentence is, and of course the court will act to determine where should we come down from that, and in that reference we have to have some notion of proportionality. I think the Minnesota Supreme Court in State v. Chanson, which I cited, requires that we do look at where essentially the sentence is coming from and how far it goes. There has to bear some proportionality for between the reasons for departure, the reasons why we are finding this to be an atypical or a special case, and why we are removing ourselves. With that, I think it is important to realize why are we making a change from a change in setting. The Supreme Court has recognized that a dispositional departure occurs when there is a change in setting from the sentence. I think there are two ways you can approach it. First of all, this could even be a change from an anticipated presumptive prison sentence down to a sentence of local confinement. So even that change from a prison to a local county workhouse could arguably be a dispositional departure in and of itself. More likely, and how we more often see this, however, is the change from some sort of incarceration status, presumptive sentence, back to some sort of probationary sentence. And the reason and the huge difference between that is you're going obviously from a place where we assume that you are not going to do well on probation. The whole key and the whole analysis for whether or not you should grant a dispositional departure relies on amenability to probation.
Can I ask you, what if we agree with you that there was an adequate basis for a dispositional departure? But we disagree with you on the durational departure. Mm-hmm. How would the judge resentence in this case?
Because
this is what bothers me about your argument, because I don't know when you basically play out the hand. How does it? What will the judge do then, if we agree on at least part of the basis and disagree on the other part?
So if I could actually play this out in maybe three scenarios. Let's say, for example, that there are grounds for a dispositional departure, but there are not grounds for a durational departure. The court would execute the mandatory 24 months. However, finding that Mr. Royster is amenable probation or there's things that he can meet in the community, he could receive a 24-month stay of execution. That would meet those grounds. If he's able to find whatever resources in the community, whatever sort of sanctioned local workhouse, that would be appropriate. Let's say that the judge were to find that there is not grounds for a dispositional departure, but strictly a durational departure down to a gross misdemeanor, 364 days. In that case, I think the court is required, in looking back at the required presumptive sentence, is required to execute 364 days in the workhouse. I think, at least keeping with the spirit and intent of the presumptive sentence, it is that this person is not amenable to probation, this person is not amenable to work with community programming, that there's some sort of public safety risk. With that, the incarceration is the best answer for the community, it's the best way to protect public safety, and simply we're going to punish you. But it still
gives...
What
about appellant's argument that if there's a durational departure down to 365 days, then it's no longer a felony and the sentencing guidelines don't apply?
Thank you. Your Honor, my response to that is...
We don't have to consider whether there's a dispositional departure.
Again, my argument would be is that we have to consider where we are coming from. It's not simply that we are working in misdemeanor territory to begin with or to end with. The key is that he has been convicted of a felony-level offense. He's been convicted of a felony-level offense with a mandatory prison sentence. We can't simply say that, all right, if the judge says it's not enough, that we ignore the fact that this is, first of all, a presumptive prison sentence. We just can't ignore that and say, okay, you've hit this magic threshold where you're, well, really not that bad. That's the entire point. Really, I think this is where it kind of dovetails with the mandatory minimum issue, is that the legislature has made a clear statement that arguably predatory offender registration conduct in and of itself is de minimis. You're not turning in forms. You're not reporting where you're living. That conduct in itself is maybe not as what we consider the most criminal. The problem is why it is so heavily punished and why an issue is because of the public safety risk it presents. Looking at that is, why is it that it's simply if we go to misdemeanor land or that there's a durational departure for a short period of time, it doesn't eliminate that safety risk that there. It doesn't eliminate the fact that we should consider that these are folks who are giving an opportunity, really, or a break to say, yes, it was not the worst violation, but we have to acknowledge that we are departing from the legislature's intent to have a serious consequence, to have a serious, one could argue, a...
Well, in answer to Judge Cochran's question, is there some authority you can point us to that I mean, but both of you are making the argument that mm-hmm. this all depends on whether the durational departure results in a gross misdemeanor. Your opponent is saying, it makes a big difference because then the guidelines don't apply, and you're saying they do. So how do we determine that?
Thank you. I would agree there really isn't any authority on the specific question. I really do think it is a novel issue. I cannot find anything on point about what happens when you make this transition. But I would center it in that what comes at the basis of a departure is going back to the nature of what we are doing is we have to make a proportionate response, taking about into consideration where we are coming from.
Okay. Well, you got interrupted because you had three scenarios.
Yep.
And I want to talk to you about the three scenarios because if we send this back, we've got to give this district court some guidance here. So what would be the third scenario?
In that case, grounds for both a durational departure and a dispositional departure, in which case the court would have to make findings, first of all, on the durational departure, that it could be offense-related characteristics. I believe offense-related characteristics can also be used to support a dispositional departure. But offender-based characteristics can only go towards the dispositional departure. So the focus is you do have to make these two separate findings. You do have to make two separate justifications why you are changing the setting from an incarceration presumptive sentence to a non-incarceration sentence.
If we agree that the durational departure is supported by the record and that the offense is less onerous, can that also support the dispositional departure? That reason? There's case law that says that even if the reason given by the court is not adequate, the Court of Appeals can look at the record to see if there's other reasons that support the departure.
I do think that under, I believe it's State versus Beal, that this court does acknowledge that we can use offense-based characteristics to support a dispositional departure.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I believe those grounds would be fair, that those could be used as a justification for that departure. But I think the court has to specifically note why that would maybe relate why a change of setting is appropriate and incorporate that into the findings. And the state's basis here, at least in this instance, is the court's finding and justification for making that change and setting that dispositional departure is insufficient and not supported by the record.
All right. But if, can you have the same reason support both, or do they have to be independent reasons, I guess is my question. Even though we can consider offense-related reasons, do you have to have separate reasons for both, or can the same reason support both a durational and a dispositional departure?
I think you can have the same factual basis for both, but I do think there's a little bit of a different analysis about how they are being used and why they merit a different sentencing outcome. So yes, you can use the same facts, you can say in this, use the same circumstances as a basis for departure, but there has to be, I think, a little bit of a different analysis about why the court feels justified about changing the sentence, first of all, as a duration, as a reflection of the seriousness of the offense, and with a dispositional departure, the merits of the offender, or if there's something about the nature of the offense that make it more appropriate that a probation sentence is given.
All right. I just want to make sure I understand your argument. If we decide that there is a basis for the durational departure, mm-hmm. but there is not a sufficient basis for a dispositional departure, would we be under your scenario two, which would be 365 days executed?
Correct.
All right. And the state is agreeable to that?
The state would be, because the consideration is you are keeping, you're maintaining the fact that this is not a person who's amenable to a dispositional departure, but the court recognizing if there's grounds for the durational departure, that reflects the severity, but you're still showing that this person is not amenable to probation, there still may be a safety risk, just his crime does not merit the type of punishment of 24 months in prison.
All right.
On the question of direct versus circumstantial evidence, could you respond briefly to the question that I had earlier as to whether this is direct evidence, is testimony, or it's circumstantial?
You know, I think there are a couple instances where it is absolutely direct evidence. He goes in, as you noted, to the City Hall, the Minneapolis Police Department, asking for forms. He knows he has to register. He goes out seeking legal advice from multiple attorneys about his requirements. He's already been doing it for several times. He has signed sheets, you know, which he says, I am acknowledging. I'm Xing my box on my 26 points of duty.
And he just filled out a change of address form 2 months earlier.
That is correct, Your Honor. I think the last time.
Months, I guess it's June, July, August, September, October. So.
Your Honor, in July 5th of 2017, he filled out a change of address for the 3746 Thomas Avenue, which is the where he was supposed to be registering. He filled out a 26-point duty to register reminder on December 23rd of 2016. So less than a year before that, he had reaffirmed all the 26 duties, which includes a statement of when he is to register, when he is to come and report the fact that if I am moving, I have to give 5 days' notice, or if it's under that, immediately. The other exception is if you move into a new area, you are not part of that jurisdiction, you have 24 hours to report your presence.
But is his testimony about his discussion with his attorney sufficiently clear that it shows that he knew he had to register?
Yeah, I think if you look at the totality of the testimony, he's clearly saying, I know I have to register. I went for advice on how to deal with this. How do I do it? Where do I go? He even testified, I believe, that he acknowledged that they told me multiple attorneys told me I had to register immediately. I think that's on trial transcript at page 91. Page 97. We also have the acknowledgement that he's aware of the order and what's required of him on the level 3 notice requirements, because that's why he didn't register with his grandmother's address. They were aware of the fact that if I register here, there's going to be notice requirements. My grandmother didn't want me to do that. Therefore, I didn't register here where he was actually staying. I think the court actually made a specific footnote about how problematic a disingenuous registration that he is homeless when he's in fact staying with his mother. The court noted that was a fact that they had established, but they didn't get into
for his legal grandmother.
For his grandmother or for him, you know, is that really a genuine reporting if he's saying I'm homeless, but he's actually living with his grandmother? The court didn't go there, but they acknowledged that there was testimony to support that fact. I think all of those circumstances go to where he knows what he's supposed to be doing. He's been doing it before. He's seeking advice. He's actively gone out of his way to figure out what he has to do. So when he shows up on October 3rd, certainly, he is following through on what I think is a fair inference that he got advice to it, but he knows he's supposed to be there. He's not there looking for property. He's not there looking for instruction. I want my forms. I need to fill them out. when they say it's not available or you have to do it immediately, he goes, well, if I can't take it with me, I'm not going to do it. I don't think there is any mystery about his purpose there on October 3rd. With that, if there's any other questions, I think I noted my factual why I believed with the sentencing arguments. I know the facts, I think, depart from Judge Cook's reasoning. Other than that, if there's no further questions, I'll complete my time.
Thank you.
Just real briefly, I think Judge Cook is perfectly aware of the purpose of the statute and why we have predatory offender registration. So this idea that, the legislature has said A and this is the problem, I think the judge knows that. I think it would be wrong to assume he doesn't. If the legislature had wanted a true, hard, mandatory minimum sentence here, they would have done it. They didn't do it. In fact, they very specifically allow for departures. Nothing in the guidelines, case law, or any statute says that the sentence in this situation would have to be a 365-day executed jail sentence. Nothing says that. And in fact, it has kind of a perverse result of, well, you're going to go sit in the workhouse for two-thirds of 365 days and then be done.
Because it seems like this is turning on whether once there's been a durational departure that brings it into a gross misdemeanor sentence versus a felony sentence, that your main argument is that the guidelines don't apply. And I'm asking both of you for authority. Where in the guidelines or anywhere do you get the idea that that's the case?
My authority is simply just the kind of black letter of the guidelines don't apply to gross misdemeanor sentences. Once we have a gross misdemeanor sentence, they don't apply. I can't point you to a case because I really don't think this specific thing has come up. But I think if you execute the 365 days, if that becomes the sentence that has to happen, there's no probationary term.
All right. But the argument is by the state is that this was a felony level sentence. And because it starts out as a felony level offense, that the guidelines do apply.
Yeah, and I don't...
And is there anywhere in the guidelines that address that issue when you start out with the felony level offense and through sentencing you change that...
To a gross,
that all of a sudden they don't... the guidelines don't apply.
I don't think it gets answered either way in the guidelines.
Okay.
I just know
what
that...
What about the statute that allows for a departure... Does that provide any guidance?
Which statute, Chairman?
Well, or you mentioned that if the legislature wanted a true, hard sentence, it would have provided that, but the legislature has allowed for departures.
Right. That is just the subdivision in the predatory offender statute. It basically says you don't have to impose the 24 months as long as you follow the guidelines, which are substantial compelling reasons. It's a departure from the guidelines. That's all it says. But if they'd wanted a 24-month hard prison sentence, they know how to do that. They do it in all kinds of statutes. I do agree with the state that the same facts can support the durational and dispositional departure. When you put somebody on probation based on the characteristics of the crime, you are doing a slightly different analysis as a trial judge, because what you are saying is this offense does not merit incarceration within the prisons, a commit to prison. So it's a slightly different analysis than we usually see in probation cases, which is there is something about the offender that is going, that I'm going to give you a chance. This is a different kind of dispositional departure when you rely on the crime. You're saying you're guilty, but I don't think it's the kind of thing I send you to prison for. Thank you.
Well, can I ask you this?
Go ahead.
Okay. Let's assume, as hypothetically, because I'm trying to figure out how this will work upon remand, that we decide that there is sufficient support for the durational departure, but not for a dispositional departure. And we also decide that the state is correct on how we interpret whether the guidelines apply to the dispositional departure. Is the state correct that then it would just be an executed 365-day sentence?
It would be an executed. It would be an executed jail sentence between 91 and 365. I do not understand why it has to be 365 days. It is a gross misdemeanor sentence. 91 would satisfy it. What I was going to say, it leads to a little bit of a perverse result because then there's no probation. And if the judge thinks that there are reasons, things that he would like done, he's not holding anything over the defendant's head.
And see, that's what bothered me too, because sometimes judges will depart either dispositionally or durationally, but they'll add on a longer probation or in kind of as a trade-off.
Absolutely. I see my light is on.
And so, yeah.
No, you can continue.
Well, I'll just finish there. I think that's why, that I think is a real problem with the state's argument, and one of the points I was trying to make earlier is I think it's backwards. The idea that the judge has the power to execute a jail sentence and not be okay, that would be okay. It seems odd to me that if the judge wants to keep him on probation, he can't do that without finding more reasons. That's backwards.
For example, in this case, he's got 1 year with him.
Two, I think.
Well, but if he eliminates probation.
Oh, yeah. If he eliminates probation.
It turns from a 2-year court supervision to a basic 1 year.
Two-thirds of 1 year in the workhouse with nothing happening.
Correct.
Except dead workhouse time. I would also say that you have to remember there is a jail sentence imposed in this case. He gets a sanction. It's not just nothing happens to him. He has a sanction. So thank you.
All right, thank you.
I have one follow-up question with regard to the sentencing guideline. I thought you were going to look at that.
You know, I did look at it, and if I looked at the right one, 2D1A?
Yes.
Okay. Quote, a court departing from the presumptive disposition as well as the presumptive duration has made two separate departure decisions, each requiring written departure reasons. I think it can be the same reason. You just have to say, I did the departure for this. I did the dispositional for this reason, the durational for this reason. It just requires you to justify correctly the reason.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. It was arguments. It was well briefed and well argued by both parties.